Let's go through every single package installed on a Linux install DVD, specifically Slackware 14.2. Of course, these are all open source packages that I'm talking about on this show, so they probably can still apply to you, even if you're not running Slackware and even if you're not running Linux. These are open source packages, so you can download the source code and run them on any computer, whether you're running Linux, Mac, Windows, BSD, doesn't matter. You can learn probably something from this episode. So let's get started. In today's episode, I'm going to talk about Aggregator. That's A-K-R-E-G-A-T-O-R. Aggregator. Like aggregator, except with a K, because it's K-D-E. Aggregator, I don't typically use as its own thing. I use it as part of Kontakt. But the nice thing about Kontakt, K-O-N-T-A-C-T, is that you can use it as Kontakt, or you can launch each individual application that Kontakt contains as its own window, as its own service. And you can also interact with it through console, which we talked about in the previous episode with console calendar. So lots of flexibility here, which I'm really, really liking. And to be honest, you kind of got to get used to that with KDE. That is one of the, you know, a lot of people, if you look at GNOME and you look at KDE, the classic, I guess, difference between the two would be, well, GNOME is simple and KDE is complex. And those are just two somewhat arbitrary terms. You might hear people also say GNOME is, I don't know, maybe they would call it minimal or something. And other people might say that KDE is bloated or something like that. So it just kind of depends on your perspective. For me, though, KDE has always been about options, about configurability, about customization. And that never concerns me. That doesn't bother me at all, personally. Because I look at that and I think to myself, that gives me the tools that I need to design my own experience. The potential problem there is that some people don't want to design their own experience, and I understand that. So I do not say, you know, I wouldn't say that KDE is necessarily for everyone. I would, I think, kind of say that probably if KDE was all that we had, I think that would be okay, because it's so flexible that you could then design different experiences for different users. And earlier in KDE's life, there were attempts to make that clear to people. And I really liked the idea. It never quite took off. I don't feel like it ever got quite as fleshed out and developed as it could have. But I remember back in 4.8, maybe 4.6, something like that, there was a screen where you could choose the interface style, and I don't know, maybe this still exists and I just haven't noticed it lately. I haven't gone looking for it. But I guess I could go look for it right now, although I shouldn't because this isn't part of this discussion. But there was a time where you could choose the kind of display that you wanted to interact with. And one of the choices, for instance, was a kind of three button interface. You know, it was just like your desktop and no menus. It was just big buttons for applications. And the idea was that you would open your, at that time, your netbook, which is what they called the EEE PC and related really, really small laptops. And you would open that. And because it was such a small device, you could treat it more almost like, you know, at least the interface, more like a mobile instead of a desktop. And so they had that available as part of KDE. You could switch over to the, whatever they called it, the simple desktop interface or something like that. And like I say, maybe they still have that, I don't know. But in other words, what I'm saying is that if you give me lots of options, I'm happy, because I know, I understand that I can ignore 50 of them and use the 5 that I prefer or that I like, that I actually use. And I'm fine if there are 50 things that I'm not using over there in the corner, because they don't get in the way. Anyway, Aggregator is an application. You can access it through Kontakt, or you can just launch it on its own, And it is a feed reader. That is all it does. It pulls RSS feeds from the internet and delivers the content into an email-like interface, for lack of a better example or a better simile. So the RSS feeds are, of course, the technology that kind of came to a head, I guess, during, I guess, the height of Web 2.0, or maybe the beginning of Web 2.0. I don't know. I'm trying to figure out how far back to go here now, because now I've mentioned Web 2.0. If you don't know what Web 2.0 is, well, there was the web, and then there was Web 2.0. And from what I recall, Web 2.0, the big thing that differentiated it from just the web, was that Web 2.0 was an interactive experience. Users, people who went to the internet formerly just to look up information, were now part of the building process. Users could make comments. They could vote on things. They could go and submit stories to websites like Slashdot and what's that other one that's no longer around? I forget what it's called, duplicitous or scriptacular or something like that. But you know, the idea was that the users were going to sort of generate their own content for the internet, and that was the exciting thing about Web 2.0. There might have been other things about REST APIs and things like that, but from I think a casual user's perspective, Web 2.0 was ushering in this interactive experience. And not that RSS is interactive, but one of the things that sort of happened around the same time is that blogs became very popular. You had normal people who didn't know how to design a website. They were writing blogs. They were becoming sort of journalists on the internet. They were self-publishing on this platform that no one had really thought of as for, you know, as something that casual users really were meant to use in a serious way beyond weird GeoCities websites. So they were starting to make things with like WordPress and Drupal and other Joomla and other platforms like that, software like that. And as part of that structure, someone came up with this idea of RSS. And it was really simple syndication. The sad thing about RSS is that its XML is atrocious. It might be simple syndication, but wow, is it just an ugly format. So luckily, there's been an improvement upon RSS called Atom, Atom. You'll notice that GNU World Order, this podcast, has both an RSS feed and an Atom feed. And I do that largely because I just every time I look at RSS, I wish it were Atom. And so I just can't have RSS out there without accompanying it with an Atom feed on principle alone. Ken Fallon actually got me looking at it critically, and that's why to this day I have an Atom feed. So Aggregator doesn't care what you tell it to read, it understands both. And the setup is pretty simple. You go to File. No, you don't. Where do you go to? You go to feed. There you go. Feed, it's a menu. You go to feed and you go to add feed. I don't add feeds all that often. I've got my feed set up and it's kind of set to go now. So anyway, you go to feed, add feed, and all it needs is a URL. And so you can give it a URL of a RSS or an Atom feed, such as let's do, I don't know, let me think. Here's one. Opensource.com/feed happens to be that website's RSS feed. Now, is that the only format for a URL containing a RSS feed? No, of course not. There's lots of different things. People can call these things whatever they want. So, for instance, I might add a feed and go to https://nvd, that's November Victor delta.nist.gov/feeds/xml/cve/misc/nvd-rss-analyzed.xml. That's the RSS feed for the CVE bug database, or one of them anyway. And lots of others. I mean, there's kde.news. That's always a good one. That's kind of built in, but you could do it. And that one's kde.org/.kde.org.rdf. So anyway, you can add feeds in there all you want. And then after a while, I mean, you can click on, there's a toolbar that says fetch feed or fetch all feeds. So I'll click fetch all feeds. I mean, it would do that on its own or anyway, but I'm forcing it to scan all of the feeds for updates. And actually it isn't fetching any because it is up to date. The nice thing about aggregator is that it just runs in the background. I mean, as you know, if you've launched Contact or aggregator itself, it kind of goes up into the toolbar, the system tray rather, or I guess down. I have my KDE picker at the top of my screen, but if you have it on the bottom of your screen, then it goes down into the system tray. Wherever your system tray is located, it sits there and updates things all day. You know, you'll get new stories throughout the day as things are posted. So it's quite nice. And then you can read the story in aggregator. So, I mean, you don't necessarily get to if the RSS feed doesn't contain the story. Some things don't. They just show you the first paragraph, and then they have a link to read more of that story, and you click on that. And in theory, it would then open up a web browser, and you could continue reading. But in aggregator, again, because it's got KDE has a pretty darned good HTML rendering engine. How good is it? Oh, let me tell you how good it is, actually. Apple computers took the KDE HTML rendering engine called KHTML, forked it, and released it as WebKit, which, of course, everyone knows now because it's the foundation for a bunch of different browsers, including Google, which forked, I think, WebKit for Blink or something like that. Is that right? I could be wrong about that. But the thing is that it's all over the place. It's hugely influential. So KHTML exists, and it is just a component of the KDE framework, and so it can be integrated into really any K application, and indeed it is. So you click on read more, and I mean, you know, technically I guess we could say yes, it is opening a web browser, because I mean, if it's a KDE or if it's an HTML rendering engine, I guess it kind of qualifies as a web browser, but it does it in a tab. And so you can just read the whole story just right there in that little mini browser. So really, really convenient. It's really nice to have an RSS feed reader. I think it's just such a nice feature, because that saves me from going sort of onto the internet in a way. I mean, I'm obviously going onto the internet because I am pulling data from the internet. But in other words, I don't have to consciously open a web browser, navigate to a site, endure its front page, look at its pop-up ad. Well, I wouldn't look at that anyway. I have a web, an ad blocker and stuff. But you know what I mean? You don't have to go to the thing. And whether that's a feature for you because you're lazy and you just don't want to have to go and open an internet browser, which is kind of me. But also, I mean, that you know, the internet can be very distracting as well. So you go to one site to check to see if there's any new stories, and then you end up looking at cat pictures or something. You know, it's very easy to get distracted sometimes if you're that sort of person. So that's kind of a feature for some people as well. For me, it's a matter of not only being too lazy to do all the clicks required to open up an internet browser and then go to each and every page. It is a sheer number thing though as well. I don't follow a lot of sites, but I do follow stuff on enough sites to make it inconvenient to physically go check all the time to see what kind of new content they have. I would rather have the content delivered to one place, aggregator, and that way I could look through the headlines really quick, see if there's anything I'm interested in, read whatever I am interested in, and ignore the rest, mark the rest as read. And that is, of course, the thing that you can do. If you've got a bunch of articles that you haven't bothered reading, which actually I do right here, there's a Planet KDE PIM, and it's still active. It's just, it is not something that I look at all the time. There's a lot of, there's actually a lot of good stuff in there. I just, Oh, wow. Notes on packaging Krita with G-Mike. Yeah, actually, this is really good. I was going to do as an example, I could mark the feed as red, meaning everything in this feed would just show up in as red. But I don't actually want to do that because that's really good. How about CVE? I'm not going to look at... I mean, I will look at that, but I don't need to look at the ones from, like, 2021, probably. So I'm going to mark that feed as red, and all of the articles now in the CVE report shows up as processed. So and a lot of the CVE reports are kind of repetitious anyway. I mean, they're not, but I generally scan for the software that it is affecting. And so, for instance, Unitrend's backup, well, that doesn't apply to me, so I am happy to select all of those and mark all of those as red, because I just don't need to, I don't need to find out what is up in that particular software. It wouldn't hurt me to find out, but I mean, that's just not something that's important. So yeah, there's a lot of flexibility here. It's essentially, like I say, it's a lot like an email application. It's just, instead of for email, it's for articles from the internet. And I think it's just the greatest thing, really. I don't know what I would do without a good feed reader. I know a lot of people had online feed readers, which I guess for me, in a weird way, defeats the purpose. It's not that I don't like the internet. It's not like that I don't like an internet browser. It's just, to be honest, not something I necessarily need to interact with all the time. And so I like those little adjunct applications that kind of keep me out of the browser for a while. I like that. So And as I say, the beautiful thing about it is that once you open it up, it pops up into the system tray, and there it sits. And it gets updates throughout the day, so you can check in, you know, at the start of your day and at the end of your day, or during your lunch break or whatever, and get all the content that you want. Highly, highly recommended. The great, great thing about Aggregator too is that you're kind of archiving, depending on the feed, but you might be archiving a bunch of interesting content. And I have actually bailed a couple of people out before who, you know, for whatever reason, their feed got corrupted or destroyed or something. And I have been able to, I mean, it's a bit of a hack and it's not beautiful, but you can extract the feed from Aggregator and rebuild it from there. So it's kind of a nice kind of, it's just part of, I guess, the distributed backup that the internet and consuming content from the internet ends up kind of enabling. So that's Aggregator. I don't know that I have a whole lot more to say about it. Let me see if there's anything super cool in the package itself that I'm not thinking of. No, there's not. There's Aggregator Storage Exporter, but it's not well documented, and I can't really do a whole lot with a not well documented command. I mean, it's so not well documented that if you type in dash dash help, it returns quote dash dash help. So I'm not really entirely sure what it, I mean, if you just type it in with nothing, you're kind of prompted. It says Aggregator storage exporter bracket dash dash base64 close bracket URL. So obviously, I guess it's gonna, you know, if I do like base64 example.com, then I get in quotes, I get something in base64. I imagine it's probably example.com. So I assume it's doing something useful, probably for Aggregator, maybe. That's how it is naming the sort of storage component, or the storage objects for a feed, maybe. I'm not sure. I don't know why users would need access to it, but that is a command that gets installed. But other than that, the other binary installed with the package is Aggregator itself. Okay, it's time for coffee, and then we're going to come back and take some listener feedback. Thank you. coffee, let's continue the show with listener feedback. Going through some listener feedback in no particular order other than the order I stumble across them as I look through the various places that they arrive. First one here is from Carl. Carl says, I'm not new to computers, Linux, or even open source, but up until recently, I've been a consumer only. It's been just the past couple of years where I've started to be a contributor in my own little way, and I must say it's been extremely rewarding. I maintain a handful of packages for Alpine Linux, one of which is a small but feature-rich web server called Alt-HTTPD. This is Klaatu here. I'd not heard of that one. I do follow a couple of different sort of tiny web server projects, not really for any reason lately. I've probably just settled on Nginx, if I'm honest, just because that's what I seem to keep installing, so I guess that must mean something. But that's a cool one to know about. I'll have to check that one out. Okay, back to Carl. He says, I had an issue with the last modified header returning the string UTC instead of GMT, which caused errors with some clients like wget and apk, the Alpine package manager. I had a trivial patch accepted within Alpine and reported the issue upstream, but didn't get a response. Over the course of the last week, there was new activity at the Alt-HTTPD repository by a developer named Stephen Beal, who was adding TLS support to Alt-HTTPD, and in the process got back to me about my GMT patch and accepted it, which was really cool. Anyway, I checked out Stephen's website and thought of you because of his section on tabletop gaming, which I thought you might find of interest, and also his code repos, which enable some tools for generating card games and things. I hope you have a great 2022. So this is really obviously maybe very cool. I think it's obvious, but it's really neat. So Alt-HTTPD is hosted at least on sqlite.org. So I don't know what that means in terms of sort of where it comes from and who wrote it. I almost suspect that maybe it is associated with Fossil, SQLite, that whole, I mean, I guess it is associated by the fact that it exists on sqlite.org. But I kind of wonder if it's mixed up with, for instance, Fossil. I didn't do a whole lot of, I read the page, but it didn't give sort of a history of the project, and I didn't go searching it down. But it looks very cool, and so I'm going to have to try it at some point, definitely. So Stephen Beal's website is wanderinghorse.com, or .net, sorry, /home/Stephen. And it does indeed have a bunch of really, really cool physical gaming resources that are just really, really nice. And so if you are into that sort of thing, absolutely go check out this site, wanderinghorse.net. Hopefully it has an RSS feed, because if it does, I will definitely subscribe to it. But I will admit, I have not come across an RSS feed on it yet. That said, sometimes they are a little bit hidden away. You know, sometimes they're just kind of like the website slash, for instance, RSS. Not in this case. How about /feed? No. So I'm not sure if that has an RSS feed. But anyway, it's a very cool site, and now I know about it. So Alt-HTTPD and wanderinghorse.net if you're into gaming or Linux, really, because both apply there. Or I guess I should say, Linux, actually. I was trying to be more specific, like, you know, running a Linux server or something, but, I mean, that counts, it's Linux. Okay, so next up is going to be Deep Geek, who had a sort of a, by his own admission, a meandering GNU World Order feedback. He says, hey, Klaatu, wanted to write a few GWO-related things to you, but they are all small things, so use as many or as few as you like on the show, but still things I wanted to let you know of. So here we go. First off, I feel I put a little curse on myself when I wrote to you that I had no problem using systemd. I recently had a ZFS problem, and systemd got in the way of troubleshooting. It was a minor thing, but there are many, many interactions between ZFS and systemd, and its complicated nature got to me. I remember the pride I felt that sysvinit was supported as an alternative startup system in Debian, so I went over to it. I found it much easier to control than systemd once I got it into place. A pleasant surprise to me was the fact that it uses this new program called StartPAR, which starts daemons and services in parallel. So it's fast, too. I'll just have to use Flatpaks instead of Snaps in the future, which I think should be fine. Yeah, this is, I mean, that's great. A great little story, really. I mean, I not having enough experience with ZFS, I have nothing to comment on this whatsoever. And you know, my interactions with systemd so far have not really focused on the troubleshooting. I mean, I have had to troubleshoot things on a systemd system, quite a number of things, really, but nothing, I guess, I mean, certainly not ZFS. So right there, that's not the same. Is there a problem with sort of the way ZFS and systemd interact, or if not a problem, subtleties that maybe make it complex? I don't know. Apparently it was too complex for DeepGeek, which could mean that he either didn't want to sit down and figure it out, or it means that it was just kind of not reasonably simple. And apparently SysV in it for him was made it simpler. Yeah, I guess what I'm saying is it's an anecdote, and I don't know what it shows, but it shows for me that the one thing it shows is that having alternatives is really, really important. And I do hope that people keep that in mind, like that we all keep that in mind as we're developing stuff, because if systemd actually did become the only option, I think that would be not optimal. And, you know, I mean, it is the only option, sort of, in a way, on some distributions. So is that the right choice to make for your distribution? I don't know. I mean, it depends, you know? I mean, like, I guess it just depends on how you view your distribution. And certain distributions tend to see themselves as a product, and others see themselves, I think, more as a toolkit. I don't know one is worse than the other or better than the other. I'm just saying I think there is a difference there. I think Debian is definitely among those that views itself more as a toolkit, or at least is viewed as a toolkit. And then I think that they support that view by supporting a bunch of different options. And honestly, I mean, even Slackware, while it doesn't necessarily support different options, it does support different options. I've run systemd on Slackware. I had a friend who got me into doing it. I mean, not in production or anything, but as an interesting experiment. I've swapped out for the BSD init system on Slackware for ninit, N-I-N-T, not minute, but ninit. And you know, you could do it with BusyBox. You can swap the things out on these distributions. And that's a really, really refreshing thing, I think, for some people. For other people, they're just never going to do it. So anyway, interesting anecdote, good to know about, something to watch out for if you're going to be running ZFS on a systemd system, possibly. It would also be interesting to hear more about, like, OpenZFS and, well, even ButterFS, I guess, is the eternal question. Anyway, DeepGeek continues, would love a full episode on package source. I actually went into your archive and pulled out your old one, which was a part of an episode thing, and I wanted more depth. So if I have a vote, I say yes, please, to the idea of a package source episode. I know you and I are different, as I happen to like package managers, but for me, package managers is a great tool to help me build vastly different systems as the situation requires. But I do want to know about it as well, as try it sometime. And yeah, I should do a package source episode, and maybe I'll just do a NetBSD episode, because there are some subtleties to how NetBSD works just in general that I think are interesting to hear about. You know, there's a lot of, especially for a Slackware user, you look at NetBSD, and maybe other BSDs as well, but certainly NetBSD for me, because that's the one I'm using. You look at it, and it looks and feels just surprisingly similar in many, many ways. But then there are weird little things, like, for instance, when you're enabling a service. Everything's in /etc/rc.d, but they don't start with rc dot. Not a big deal, but it's something to be aware of, because if you're sitting there doing an sudo /etc/, you know, trying to start a thing in rc dot, and you're tabbing, and there's nothing there, that's why. There's nothing that starts with rc dot. D is just the name of the thing. The daemon. And then even like when you're in, if you start it and it's not enabled, that's considered not something that you should be doing, and so you have to do it specifically with a special command, one start or one stop, and enabling it is a little bit different, because in Slackware, you just chmod plus x that script. NetBSD, you're supposed to list it in rc.conf, little things like that, in other words. So lots of similarities, and then suddenly differences. And package source is an interesting component of that, I think. And the difference, I guess, about package source is that it could be extracted from NetBSD, and often is, and run on some other system. And so that makes it, I think, widely of interest. So maybe something about package source and then about NetBSD or something like that. I don't know, special episode or something. Or a not special episode, it could just be any episode. But there you go, that's I'll definitely do something about that. I probably need to sit down and run package source on something other than my Raspberry Pi, though. I mean, I've run it on my laptop, I've run it on Slackware. I've never fully committed to it, because I've always had another packaging option on a system, and package source doesn't have literally everything that I need, so it's always been kind of an adjunct, and kind of an awkward adjunct at that, because, as I've said before, it really wants to see a certain base level of a certain foundation of installations which get put into user package whatever, and so you've got kind of this other system lingering around on your system just for the package source packages, and that just has always felt a little bit weird. I and believe me, dear listener, I understand that this is coming from someone who says, I'm really enjoying flat packs, I don't care about the duplication. So yes, I understand the hypocrisy there. I'm not saying it makes sense, I'm simply saying it's always kind of, it's just been a weird thing, and I can't quite fully commit. And the reason I can't quite fully commit is because it doesn't have all of the packages that I want. So on Slackware, I mean, Slackware doesn't have all the packages I want either, and neither does Slack builds, but I have sort of a system down to how to get everything that I do want on Slackware, and that's an amalgamation of Slack builds, of flat packs, of custom scripts, and so on. So I put it all together, documented on slackermedia.info, and there you go. Adding package source into the mix is kind of weird, because it basically has a bunch of overlap with Slack builds, less what it doesn't have, and so it's kind of like, well, why am I doing that? So I've run it on other systems, but yeah, it does seem like it's never the package manager with the stuff that nothing else has, and it always seems to be the package manager with the stuff that everything else has. And so why do you need it? You don't necessarily. So it is a little bit of an awkward place, but boy, is it nice when you do need it. For instance, on NetBSD. Okay, so lastly, Deep Geek says, I was surprised to hear you talking about Lilo in your kernel episode. My understanding was that it was no longer developed, and I find using Refind so easy. I like the way it scans to find things it knows how to boot without a configuration file, but I do like the configuration file because I can tell it text mode, and it gives me what I think of as a Lilo-looking boot screen. I also like to add the Tiano core shell, so if something really goes wrong, I can get a shell and maybe fix things easily. Well, I just use what Slackware gives me. Lilo, I think, is not being developed, but it's being patched or something like that for some reason. And then there's also eLilo for UEFI systems. I don't remember exactly. I think I must be using eLilo. But honestly, I don't even remember at this point. This is my 14.2 system, so you have to understand this thing has been on this computer for years. I have no memory of how it got installed. All I know is that it's here, and I use it every day, and I love it. So yeah, I'm not exactly sure. I do know that, yes, I issue a command Lilo to update some file somewhere to so that when I boot, I get my new kernel in the selection menu. That's as much as I know about my boot process. Refind sounds like a great idea. Really leaning into the EFI side of things sounds like a really smart idea. I have fond memories of... Do I have fond memories, or do I just have memories? I have memories of a lot of EFI work that I did at an old job. So, yeah, maybe I should try this crazy scheme. With Slackware 15.0, I'm hoping to really kind of go out of my comfort zone in terms of file systems and maybe boot processes and certainly hard drives, because I've got this NVMe drive in this new build of my workstation that's just sitting there right now, just waiting for 15.0 to be released and to then be put onto it. So yeah, we'll see what happens there. We'll see what I end up using. Okay, and then there's a little bit of an announcement here. This is not listener feedback as such, but a friend of mine, Amalith on Mastodon, runs a bunch of really cool services. And one of the things that he's somehow involved with, and I don't exactly know his involvement, but whatever it is, I heard about it from him. So he's part of this, what's called a Fede ring. So a Fede is the prefix of Fediverse, which is an amalgamation of a, or what is it, what do you call it when you portmanteau? A federation multiverse, or universe multiverse, I don't know. So Fediverse, federation, federated universe, or multiverse, or whatever kind of verse, which means, which is a reference to Mastodon and to Identica, and the idea that web applications should consist of a bunch of self-hosted entities that connect to each other to provide sort of additional functionality and context. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, jump on Mastodon and you'll start to kind of get an idea. I mean, if you look at it without thinking, it'll just look like another website with a bunch of stuff on it. But what's really happening there is that people like you and me are running Mastodon instances on their computers, and they connect, not they don't do it manually, but they their clients connect to other running instances of Mastodon. And because they are talking to each other, you can see activity on someone else's Mastodon instance, or their Identica instance, or their GNU Social instance, or whatever is federated. You can see that information. It's a really, really big deal. It's a very significant deal, because in many ways, this probably is going to have to be, I would think, web, you know, our web. As the web moves further and further towards just being dominated and sort of controlled by very large industries, the way for normal people to still connect is through federation. Because otherwise you're just signing into someone else's website, right? And the experience you're having there is very much the experience that that corporation or that organization, whatever, has fostered and cultivated. You can see this in real life. If you talk to a friend who uses Twitter, then very, very often their world is defined by Twitter. And I don't mean that in a negative way. I'm just saying that their perception of the world is defined on Twitter. So for instance, if they wake up and there's 1,000 people or 500 or 100 people, whatever your brain can process, there's a bunch of people having an argument about bananas or apples, then their world view is that there is a great controversy about whether a banana or an apple is a better fruit. And that's a big deal because Twitter said it was a big deal. And I experience this very frequently because I think we all probably are around people who use Twitter in real life. And so you'll hear about it. They'll say, you know, they'll start talking about something and they'll say how on Twitter such and such has happened, or people are talking about that on Twitter. And that kind of, in some weird way, I guess, is supposed to give it almost like legitimacy or something. And it's really interesting to me because half the time I don't know what they're talking about. I don't know that Twitter cares about this subject. I certainly don't care about the subject. And just because Twitter apparently cares about it, I'm not going to care about it. That there's no correlation there whatsoever. But for people on Twitter, they're kind of sort of almost made to care about the thing, whatever it is. Bananas versus apples, Marvel versus DC, Linux versus Windows versus Mac, you know, whatever the hot topic is that day on Twitter, they think that it's important because it's on Twitter. And the same goes with Facebook, and the same goes with all the other websites out there. People who have signed up for a certain culture, and that can be a kind of a bummer sometimes, you know? Like, all you did was, all you thought you were doing was signing up to use some software. And what you were actually doing is joining a culture that you may or may not appreciate. And half the time, for whatever reason, people who don't appreciate it don't also seem to have the idea to then walk away from it. And I think the reason for that is because they didn't sign up for the culture. They signed up for the software. They like the software. They don't want to leave the software. The culture, maybe, they don't like. But in order to leave the culture, they have to leave the software. On Mastodon, on Federation, if you like the software, you can continue to use the software. If you dislike the culture, you can simply not connect to that culture. Now, believe me, I'm not putting on rose-tinted glasses here. I understand that some people can't walk away from culture that they find unhealthy. So it's not necessarily that evil proprietary software is forcing people to stay in abusive situations. People do that to themselves as well, and I understand that. But I'm just saying that frequently there is a weird split there. But with the Federation, if you have the will to do it, you can separate between culture and software. And sometimes that's really important. And I've really enjoyed that about Mastodon for myself. I block things left and right on Mastodon very frequently for completely, you know, arbitrary reasons. Someone just so happens to talk about milkshakes. I never want to hear about milkshakes. I will just mute that person, or maybe even mute their entire server. And you have the freedom to do that on Mastodon. It may or may not make sense to an outside observer. Doesn't matter. Whatever you want your little software interface to look like, the content you want delivered to you, or the content you want to maximize, because you can't generally guarantee what people are going to be talking about, but you get the feel for certain communities, and then you can connect to them or not. And I think that's going to be important going forward. How does this relate to Amleth and his Federing? Well, a long time ago on the internet, way before Web 2.0, there were these things called web rings. And the idea there was that you would find other websites, or someone would find a bunch of websites on similar topics, and they would invite those websites to be part of this ring. And that way you could go to, let's say it's a Lord of the Rings fan community. So you go to the Hobbit website, the Hobbit fan website, and you get your little photo tour of the Shire, and it's really neat and it's really fun. And you think, I just can't get enough Lord of the Rings content. I'm going to, but I noticed that this is on the Lord of the Rings web ring. So I'm going to click and go to the next site in the ring. And it would go to whatever the other site in the web ring is signed up. And so you would go to a different site. About this one might be about all about the Black Riders and what they were and what they are now and what they've become later. And it's a great website too. That's great fun. And so then you can go to the next web, the next site in the web ring. And so you just keep going. And eventually you would circle back around to the Shire because it is a web ring. So it would eventually end. But that was a great way to sort of almost give websites kind of like a tag, as it were, because you would know that there's some similar grouping to these websites. And you could trust more or less that within this web ring, as long as people were curating it properly, that if you click onto the next place, you'll go to some site with related content. And it was useful because that was literally before the days that Google did not exist. Web indexing hardly existed. So if you wanted a certain kind of content, that was one way to find the content, was just to find a web ring that you enjoy and then go around to all the different sites within that ring. Does it scale? Probably not. But the idea of that, I think, is a nice little... It builds small communities around web content, which I quite like. Now, a Fediverse web ring, a Federing, is basically just building a opt-in community with people on Mastodon, essentially, or in the Fediverse. So it could be Mastodon, it could be GNU Social, it could be whatever. So there's not necessarily a whole lot in common between the websites necessarily, in other words. However, I thought it was a cool idea. I think it's really neat to kind of bring back web rings And so GNU World Order is now on the Fede ring. So if you go to gnuworldorder.info, on the left-hand side, you'll find a link for the Fede ring. You can click a left arrow or a right arrow to go to the next or the previous website in the Fede ring. I cannot guarantee what you are going to find in this ring. There are going to be sites by different people from the Fediverse. So some of them are going to be highly tech-focused. Others are going to probably just be sort of interesting cultural artifacts. Who knows what you'll find? It's not necessarily, a Linux, well, it's certainly not a Linux podcast ring. And it's not even necessarily a Linux ring, but it is a ring of websites that by people who exist on the Fediverse. So GNU World Order is now part of that Fedi ring, and I think it's really great that Amalith is contributing in whatever way he is contributing to that idea. I think it's really cool. And let's see, there is a email from Matthias, who had written in earlier about this idea of kind of a mainframe setup. And so this is kind of interesting. So he says, "Many thanks for discussing the topic. I had a test setup running. A notebook served as the mainframe and a Raspberry Pi as the terminal. Both devices were in the same local area network. If I remembered correctly, they were connected to the same switch, but there is a chance that they were just patched using a patch cable and a LAN to USB dongle. The Pi had a user named student who was not asked for any password, but in /etc/password, I set a shell script as this user's shell. It basically worked like this. The Pi boots into a multi-user target. The student user and then press return. So the user is student and then you press return. The shell script emulates a login prompt. The user gives credentials for the mainframe, and then the credentials are fed to the SSH command. The actual student is to enter the scene at 4 to start a session by logging in. So that would be 4. You're not seeing the numbered list. So that's when the user gives credentials for the mainframe. So this is a fake prompt, in other words, that they're typing into. The student enters this scenario at the fourth step to start a session by logging in. The whole thing is meant to be a kind of mobile setup made up of a mainframe, 10 to 20 terminals, a switch, and some wires. I am pretty sure the Pi 400 would more than do the trick, but it lacks a display. CrowPi probably would do it too, but as you've pointed out, it's overkill." That's his email. It's such a cool project, and I would love to see something like that set up. I mean, really, like, wouldn't it be brilliant to have that set up in a big room with a bunch of, I can picture it in my head. You got the Cray, you got the VT100s, and it's perfect. It's perfect. I don't know what you would do with it. I don't know why it would exist, but it just sounds so cool. Of course, I have certain romantic ideas about that sort of, the mainframe setup and so on. I've never been around one. I've never interacted with one. I know people who have and who still are. I know someone who still uses a mainframe. Like, he's actually a mainframe programmer. DODDD or DODD dummy is still a he works on mainframes. Like, that's his job. It's crazy. So I have these ideas, and I'm sure a lot of people have similar notions of how interesting that must have been and how cool that must have been, and I just have no idea, really. That's not something I actually know anything about. I'm sure there are rough edges there that you would just not enjoy, but I still think the idea is really fun. And even, I mean, it could just be the barest emulation. It doesn't have to be a big complex true to life thing. I just think it's a lot of fun to even just to pretend like you have such a setup is kind of cool. There is, of course, I might as well mention, openmainframeproject.org, which I keep an eye on. It's still way out of my reach, but it is quite interesting. It runs projects like Open Mainframe, I don't know how to say it, Zoe project, which is like Kubernetes on a mainframe. It's fascinating stuff. I would love to just get some experience with a mainframe. I think it'd be really, really interesting and fun. I mean, there are places you can log in and use a mainframe. So that is a thing that happens. There's a podcast called I Am a Mainframer over at Open Mainframe. So you could check that out if you want. Just openmainframeproject.org/news/podcast. It's a whole different world. Fascinating stuff. Anyway, that's all the listener feedback I have, I think. I mean, I've probably forgotten something, no doubt. My inbox got a little bit carried away this time around. But I think I hit most of them. I mean, not that that matters to the person I've missed. So thank you for listening. I'm sorry if I've missed your email or Mastodon message. Next time we are going to talk about Alchemia and Analitza and Arc and maybe Articulate. We'll find out. I'll talk to you next time. Thanks for listening. My name's Klaatu. You can reach me anytime over email with feedback or comments, tips, or just to say hi. My email address is klaatu@slackermedia.info. You can also reach me on the Mastodon network, not Klaatu, at mastodon.xyz. The show's intro and outro music is by Fat Chance Lester. You can find their music on bandcamp.com or on gnuworldorder.info. In the archive, you'll find a music directory containing the album from which this music has been extracted. Until next time, thanks for listening and keep the source open.
I just don't believe you could be of any help right now.